Mr. Cosby, it is great speaking with you, especially somebody growing up watching Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. Huge fan of that. Do you think of yourself as an icon in all the things you've done, from acting to being an author and, of course, being a stand-up comedian?
Only if and when people say it. I also hear it often now. I'm in the commercial flights and sitting, waiting to be called, and people of all ages. I mean, no, an 11-year-old doesn't come up, but may come with the parent, and the parent will tell the story, and the kid will, you know, their children. But the people, the 20-something-year-old people, on to 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, and some of them brag. See, you know, they don't know anything about this, but I know about I Spy. And then, of course, there are. Last night we did a benefit for Temple University gymnastics, men's gymnastics team, which was cut from the schedule. So I went in and I performed to raise money so that they could have funds to work as a club. And we had something called a meet and greet, and that's where donors could sit next to me and take a picture, and I look like I really like them. And the stories that came, and of course this is Temple University, so a lot of these people, they never talk about my football career. They never talk about my track and field events that I brilliantly came in third and fourth place in dual meets. But they say, yeah, I remember you on campus, and I saw you, and I sat. But the shows come up, all of them, whether it's I Spy, whether it's Chet Kincaid, they don't mention so much, the variety shows. I have not heard the variety shows mentioned that much. It's Chet Kincaid, and they don't say much about the Cosby Mysteries, which I feel happens to be fantastic. That only went 1 year. Then, of course, the Huxtables, and not many, maybe not even enough change the forensic or the AD, whatever that thing, to say it was here of the a different world. That's generally if I'm with a strongly populated black audience. But when it comes to the writing and the monologues, many, many people will put me in the category of education.
But I also...
Can you hold the phone 1 sec?
Sure, no problem.
So that's the phone company. We've been having a problem with things just cutting off in the middle, and it's nice enough to have a dial tone showing that we lost the call, because prior to the person coming down and fixing it, I was talking for 2 hours, and then it's hello, hello, hello. So the whole idea of being called an icon and other things, it's very, very wonderful. I think, really believe, the first comedy special I did after the 30 years of just himself, Far From Finished, which was on Comedy Central, and still playing every now and then, I guess. It's important to me because this show business many times is for what's new and not necessarily that which is solid. And I'm not saying that it doesn't exist for people like Emmylou Harris. I'm not saying it doesn't exist for people like Toots and the Maytals. But it is a world where the newer things, the changes that come, whether it's the Seinfelds, the Chris Rocks, the Dave Chappelle's, et cetera, and what goes on with the changes and how far you can take profanity and talk about whatever you want to talk about, nudity, et cetera, et cetera.
I actually remember one of my best memories is Scoop Newsworthy for the Jackson 5 Going Back to Indiana special.
Yeah.
And I also remember in school, one of my teachers bringing in a reel, and it was you, 22 minutes, sitting in a chair with paint on your face, and I think it was called Prejudice. And you were going through
It is called Prejudice, and I wrote it because I was sick of people laughing with Archie Bunker. I just felt that his attitudes towards racially inspired these hate moments that Archie never gave the audience any kind of feel that he was sorry or that he recognized he was wrong. And so with that dislike for Archie, I then decided to take all of these stereotypes that I can remember, put them together, and put them in a way that they are then said by this ultra-hater and confused man. And he began to just sprout all the stereotypes. And the whole punchline for me was, if you laugh at this, then when it becomes your turn in the barrel, how come you're not laughing? And 22 minutes, called Prejudice. And it was quite interesting because I got a letter from a school teacher who said that she was looking for the Bill Cosby to do some kind of monologue about whatever children's play, and here was this horrible thing about people and the way you talked about people. And then I remembered my mentor, Norma Jean Anderson, at the University of Massachusetts, while I'm working on my master's and my doctorate at the School of Ed, working on my EDD. And she said to me, whenever you do something like this, you're going to have to put out a booklet. And I was hard-headed. I said, look, these are school teachers, Dr. Anderson. I don't understand why I have to make a book. I mean, if they want to teach and if they care, they'll see and they'll do this. She said, Bill, you're going to have to make a booklet and you're going to have to tell them your vision and what they need to do or what they ought to do with it. And when this teacher wrote this letter of disgust to me, I mean, wrote it at me, I thought, yeah, Dr. Anderson is correct. Because here's what the teacher didn't do. She just took for granted, this is Bill Cosby, she's going to play it for her class. She didn't even screen the darn thing. Take a look at it first. I mean, do you just take a book and say, okay, this is written by Shakespeare, and then pass it around for everybody? No. So that happened. And then the reviewers, I remember New York reviewer, I think his last name might have been Williams for me. It was, I think it might have been the Daily News, a TV thing. And in those days, the 70s or whatever, he came out and he said, well, all that's doing, all prejudice is doing, it's not saying anything new. Which meant that, you know, that's a backhanded way of saying, I'm tired of hearing about either myself or other white people or anybody who's attacking anybody or saying anything. We've all seen this. And I just thought to myself, okay, that's the way this man is running his life and putting it on paper, and he's doing no one any good in terms of TV.
I want to talk more about some other topics, too, but I hope you don't mind if I ask you about the passing of Robin Williams, if you had met him, of course, and just your thoughts on his career.
No, I'm not going to talk about his career. Everybody talks, and we all know how brilliant, and we all agree. I want to talk about pharmaceuticals. And I want to talk about the United States of America so that when I hear and read that a person, Robin Williams or someone I will probably never meet, being under the supervision of doctors for depression, suffering from depression. These medications, man, put out by the pharmaceuticals, when you read the side effects, there's something there generally that says may cause, and then it goes into a feeling that you want to be violent. May cause, and then there's something that says you may become suicidal. Stop! Why can't the pharmaceuticals pull this thing off the market? Because when we're all looking at these cases of the people going on rampages, whether it's behavior on road rage, whether it's somebody with an AK-573 just blazing into a classroom, the post office, a courtroom, and then if media goes truthful, they will report, if it exists, that the person was suffering from depression, which means this, if they're being treated for it, something after they take it a certain length of time begins to take the depressed person and they under siege. That's what I want to talk about. That's what I want stopped. There are too many stories that of the kind of suicide and a different kind of, not a different kind of suicide, but the kind where first you aim to kill from hatred, and then you take your own life. And when you look around, or read around, responsible media, generally it says the person is suffering from some sort of mental attack or weakness. And I think that this United States of America, obviously, and I can go old if you want me to. We can put a man on the moon. Why can't we? I mean, the pharmaceuticals have billions of dollars. We want to work in this United States of America to talk to people. Hold the phone 1 sec. I'm sorry.
No problem, sir.
We've got to not only sedate people, because I don't know. I went to visit a place in Newark, New Jersey, incarcerated teenagers, and the director, i.e. warden, leaned over and said to me before I got up to speak to the youth, 70% of our residents are medicated. Okay, so if you have all these kids who have some kind of violence, I mean, that's mental. It's mental. I'm asking the medical world to answer us and say, if it's mental, what does a pill that sedates and zombies them do after they've taken these things 3-4 months in a row? Where is the work that has to be done on ironing out the tangled in the brain, these messages that make things clear that we understand sociologically, behaviorally, and we can come to our chronological order to respect law and order, that of family, that of earn a living, all of these things. And we do. We have the capability. I mean, goodness knows, education. And by the way, I just want to make one statement. You started this. I didn't. So let your listeners know that I wanted to be funny, but you started it. And let us understand that in order to get an education, we pay a lot of money, college, et cetera, et cetera. And you mean to tell me this is the best we can come up with in the world of healing? And it's not just the United States. This pharmaceutical and just give them things and don't and not work on the brain, not work on trying to train the individual. You mean to tell me, man, that we can't stop? And if the pharmaceuticals, if I'm correct, I'm not sure, but it leans that way. I mean, how can you put out something? You say you may. It may cause. And you want me to take this pill? My cholesterol is 270. Okay, we have a pill for you. But it may cause your liver failure? Whoa. Next question, please, Mr. Mortician.
The next question definitely would be about back to your career, and that has to do with how do you think your comedy now has changed over the years as you've grown up and watched your family expand?
Better. I deal with what I see in my family because in that is a... what I've always been from the day of Temple University, freshman year, remedial English. I started to do what I should do because I finally, with great passion, discovered my goal. And that was to stop 7th and 8th grade boys from disregarding education, stop them from thinking that life will be all right as long as they not participate in terms of developing their education higher, further. So I wrote a composition, and then I wrote a second composition. I was not trying to be funny, nor was I trying to challenge Salinger or Mark Twain. I just wanted to tell a story, 750 words. And for the first time in my life at age 23 and a half as a freshman at Temple University in remedial English, I did what I was supposed to do, and that is make sure in this composition that I'm telling, take time to look at the mistake made, make the correction as opposed to, this is good enough, and hope that a professor would inflate my grade. No, I'm past that. And to this day, man, I can only thank that professor. I don't know where he is, and I know it's a he, because I saw him. And it was freshman year, 1960, Temple University, and it was remedial English. And he read my paper to the class. Now, the question is, was it funny? Did anybody laugh? I wasn't writing for that. I was writing to do exactly what I do today. And that is, I come out and I talk about myself and my experience and what I hear time and time again after people or during people or whatever, when I'm working concert, people talk about the connection. He was in my house. I'm suing him. How did he get in my house? How do you know that my husband does this? How do you know that my children are brain damaged? And then they go home laughing and talking about each other. A guy sat next to me last night. We're raising money for the Temple University non-athletic departmentalized men's gymnastic team. And the guy came and was sitting next to me and he said, am I the only one in this room who knows Buck and who played it? And I said to him, I don't think so, but if they don't know, then try saying Johnny on a Pony or describing it, and you may come up with some people. Say, yeah, we played that, and it was called Break Your Brother's Back. But all I know is, man, on Monday, I'm going to do the Jimmy Fallon show, and I'm going to thank him because he jumped on my back on his show. And 2 days later, I really felt that he had made an adjustment on my lumbar. My back feels fantastic now.
Oh, my goodness. And he is one crazy host. He will do everything and anything.
But here's my wife pinpointed that he is a very likable person. And that is not to mean that he's somebody that, this teacher's pet, you know, or that he's doing it to make himself look wonderful. No, this is a guy that you like and you trust, and there's a difference. It's not like you don't like John so-and-so because he sounds rudder and rudder, but you still laugh and the rudder. But this is a guy that you really feel that there's not much that he's faking to get you to come in and play three-card Monty with him.
Do you think that's why your comedy has resonated through so many generations and so many families? Because your comedy is considered trusted. You know definitely that you're not going to get the vulgar language, the swearing or anything like that, but it's an open door in your views of, like I said, family and the world. And it's been that way for comedy and, of course, your TV shows.
Yeah, I think so. Because, look, it's not just profanity and where you're going with the genitalia, et cetera, et cetera. Because there are things that you can say about God and you can say about Jesus. You can talk about Moses. You can talk about the Republican Party. You can talk about the Democrat. And you could, hey, man, if you unleash at that time, you can get some people wincing and some people later writing letters saying, listen, we were very disappointed. And we went to see you. And so what is it that I do? Exactly what you said. I am coming and I have a good idea that I am going to present. And I know, I think it's funny, and I feel funny about it, and I'm going to work it.
I don't know how much more time we have, but I just got a couple of more questions I need to ask about. Number
one. Well, when you say need, then you have to have it.
Is it true that the reason why you sit down was because some of the clubs that you performed at, the ceilings were so short, you had to sit down, and you figured that was part of your act?
No, that's a new one. That's a new theory. I walked out one night. I think it was at Harris. It was a dinner show. And I looked at the people, and they were sitting down. Harris, Lake Tahoe. And they were eating. And I went off, and I got a chair, and I came back, and I sat down. Not because of any reason, except I felt, hey, man, we're going to make this comfortable. And so I sat. Now, the reason also why it happened was because I was more comfortable with myself and my timing. I was doing things with my timing. I'm not talking about any other comedians or challenging. I was doing things with my timing where I was no longer afraid to let a space of maybe 3, 4, 5 seconds go by. Let them laugh. Let them smile. Walk comfortably with them in the storytelling. And then there are times when I know that it will be good for these people not to be able to breathe, and that they will cough and they might choke to death. But I want to hurt them. And that's when I run together certain things and keep it going and tack on top. But essentially, to walk out, and then I did it at the midnight show. They're sitting down drinking. All right, why not? I will sit down and have that comfortable too. And it's only within the last maybe 15 years that I've added a table and a rug.
My other question, when Richard Pryor was starting to become popular with his style of music, did it ever bother you? Because I know, I had read that when Eddie Murphy was becoming very popular, I had read that you actually called him and told him, hey, you can cut down the profanity.
That's not what I told him. That is not what I told him. People have misconstrued that. What I told him has already been printed. So all I have to say is Mr. Murphy has since said to me, not to me, but indirectly, that he was being defiant, and I'll let it go at that and clear it up. I don't think you can find any comedian, male or female, that I have called and said, don't curse. Richard cursed. Red Fox didn't curse, but he was naughty. Yeah. There was one lady who I addressed, and that was because she came at me with whatever her character, and I spoke to the character. And then that brought about a whole bunch of ooh. But I really don't want to do anything other than give my opinion and try maybe to give something to newer comedians about how they can use their minds to go deeper into whatever area they feel comfortable in.
The other thing I want to talk about, too, of course, is the Cosby Show and how you were able to present that, because to me, growing up and watching that show, it was a different type of family that we finally had a chance. It was a family that everybody knew about, but we never had a chance to see it on TV. Was this important for you to finally have something like that on television?
Okay, first of all, the humor is in itself. I'm doing my monologues, and I'm doing two shows a night in places of halls that seat 2,800 people. So we're looking at 5,600 people a night, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's important that these people are laughing. People of all colors, people of all races, Filipino, Puerto Rican, Cuban, African-American, people from Trinidad, people from Ireland, people born English, don't know what they are, but they know they're white. They're laughing. And they're talking, and they're laughing because I'm talking about family. I'm black. They can see that. So I don't have to bring that out. Okay, do I stop and talk about murders, shooting, drug dealers? That stuff is not funny to me. And it comes under, as far as I'm concerned, lecturing. Because I really don't see humor, and I never have. I've never thought it was funny to address that as a Negro colored African American, I have to go sit at a different lunch counter, but dress up to go to war. So that kind of thing, and it was said. I mean, these things were said by Dick Gregory. They were said by Muhammad Ali. Said by Richard Pryor. So where did the changes come from? I didn't hear any. I didn't see the world change. I saw them laugh because of that. But it's something that here we are, 2014, and you got these idiots looking at an African-American president. And we've got idiots of all colors miscalling what he is doing. So to look up at me and to see the color, and then I start to talk about, when you see Fat Albert, you see the color of these people. You see them and you identify. When you see Little Bill, you identify, you see what he's talking about. You fall in love with these people. And for me, I was given an opportunity to bring into play a married couple with five children, and the whole idea was, I want to take the house back. I want to take it away from these idiots who are writing sitcoms where the children know more than the parents. And I wanted to show that there's something wrong. And it's not even a matter of, oh, by the way, because that's wrong to say, you know, I don't see you as being a Negro. I see you a person who happens to be. Okay, well, then if I want to counter that, I say, well, you know, you happen to be a white person. I mean, how do you feel about being somebody who happens to be? No, I am what you see, what you hear, and what you feel. And that is, I'm a human being, black. Not who happens to be black. I'm a human being, period. And so when people saw this show, and they laughed, and they identified because the writing was from the same attitude as that comedian standing on the stage doing 5,600 people a night and having them laugh, selling records, best-selling this and that. And it's absolutely wonderful, and I'm getting ready to get on this horse again. Now, the horse is not old. The horse is not tired. The horse is not something that people will look at and say, well, that was. And the reason is because we are talking about human beings. So if somebody thinks, well, you know, things have changed. We've got computers and we've got the internet. Yes, you have. And who's dealing with it? I don't understand what you mean. No. Who's dealing with the internet? Who's dealing with the computers? Human beings. Not a new kind of morphed person. And we will bring up those things that make them the same with each other. That if people are using the internet and they're talking to each other, why do they call it talking to each other when they're actually writing while they sit there? And they're not talking to you, but they're talking to their friend on the internet, but they're not talking, they're writing. So these things become humorous when I write them. And that's the behavior and the wonderful feeling that will come about.
When do we know that? When is the new show? Because I understand it's going to be on, I do believe, NBC. When is it going to debut? Do we know?
Look, man, it's a new Aldous Huxley. It's a brand new world. I heard somebody say, well, we'll put it out in the summer. What? Well, the last time I was in the business, summer was when Americans left the house and stayed out there till at least 10 o'clock at night. And then they came home. And the numbers were so low, they didn't even bother to put anything decent on. So I'm getting scared.
Well, I'm crossing fingers that it's going to be on very, very soon.
No. Cross fingers that when we're ready and we put it on, that you look at it and you say, oh, yes, thank you. Thank you, NBC. Thank you.
Well, I have to say thank you to you because, like I said earlier, growing up, I mean, as a child, I mean, the only black cartoons we had a chance to identify with was the Jackson 5, the Harlem Globetrotters, and of course the Cosby Show. And we went from one to the other to the other. So for me, that was extremely important to be able to have.
And what I love about it is, what college did you go to?
Humber College, taking radio broadcasting here in Toronto.
Okay. And look at how you identified and could identify with people of all colors, because they were watching it also.
Absolutely. But for me, it was just being able to see that. It was like having to watch, well, not having to watch. When I watched Soul Train, it was the only time I saw black commercials, the only time whenever I got a chance to see it.
Well, here we go again. But now, you know, you don't need to watch necessarily Soul Train. They've got black people in commercials all over the joint, man.
And to me, that is extremely important because, again, it's the identifying and knowing that now I can turn it on, turn the TV set on, and things are a lot more balanced than it was in the past.
And as the man said, it said, and getting more balanced.
As we wrap this up, what is the show going to be like? What can we expect when you come to Casinorama?
Once again, going to be about life, going to be about me, telling them what I see and what I feel, and we're going to have a good time. Now, I'm telling you, there is one person I want to say hello to. and he's in Toronto. This man and I have been friends since 1962. And his name is Cy Man, and he is still my tailor. Everything you've ever seen me on where I looked sharp and smooth with a tie, Cy Man.
I will.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, sir, for this great interview.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.